In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
When you go outside of America, you meet these people who eat and live in a completely different way. They kind of have a lot of things figured out that Americans don't or have forgotten.
One thing that I saw when I was coming into the health field is that there was so much like misery instilled in it. You have to be torturing yourself if you want to be lean and healthy. You need to be super restrictive. You need to exercise yourself more than you've ever wanted to. And that's a drag.
Basically, the idea behind this is you wake up in the morning and before you even have time to think about dreading it, you do that thing, you get it out of the way, and you use it getting done as momentum into the rest of the day.
You know, 90% plus of beef that we get in the U.S. is from factory farms, which is straight out of a horror movie. You know, these animals don't even get to move their legs. And so that's starting to happen to us.
Welcome to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. We provide you with everything you need to know for total performance, fat loss, recovery, digestion, sleep, brain, and hormone optimization. So whether you're an Ironman triathlete or you just want to shed a few pounds, get ready for non-run-of-the-mill cutting-edge content from BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
Hey folks, it's Ben Greenfield and I'm here today with my friend Abel James. And I actually haven't talked to Abel in a while. Abel kind of dropped off the face of the map and occasionally I'd see him pop up on Facebook in some remote area of the world, Thailand or Peru or anywhere else on the globe. It was kind of like, where's Waldo? And I know Abel was off doing some writing and some personal adventures. And I know that he had some pretty major occurrences happen in his life that I know he'll love to share with you on this episode. But one of the things we're going to be talking about is why Abel disappeared for a while, what he was working on, and some of the very cool things that he discovered about diet, fat loss, performance, and all sorts of little things that we're going to delve into today as we talk about something called the wild diet. So James, Abel James, thanks for coming on the show, man.
Thanks for having me, Ben. And thanks for listening, listeners out there.
So tell me, why did you drop off the face of the map or go all over the map?
Yeah, it's always been something that I kind of do from time to time. And it goes back to growing up in the middle of nowhere in New Hampshire, where we would be forced to go without phone for a while, you know, because of ice storms or something like that, or we'd be snowed in. And getting a hold of my family has always been something that I don't take for granted, you know. And in today's modern world, it's like with tweets coming at you, Facebook, text messages, emails, it's really easy to kind of fall out of that peaceful, easy feeling that you get when you have a little bit of your own time to kind of hang out in nature or do things that you love. And so one thing that I promised myself and my now wife, Allison, is that whenever things got a little bit too crazy, because they have to, especially when you're building a business or when you're building a following or writing books, all that sorts of things, it does get crazy and you have to work hard. It's really important though to honor the other side of that, where you kind of collect your thoughts, you revisit who you are and what you're up to. And it's kind of neat because after living in the woods for like 8 months, you come back and realize that the world we're living now is practically Star Trek. I mean, like we're going to Mars. There are spaceships all over the. We have
Star Trek slash the space deck and the cartoon Wall-E with all the fat people in their wheelchairs with their smoothies
in between.
Yeah, interesting. So you traveled, but as you were traveling, you were writing, right?
Yeah, I've always liked. So I kind of come at all of this from the musician angle, and it was just easy to start a health show because I'm already recording artist and have been performing for a long time. And, you know, talking about health is really just an excuse to talk about cool things with anybody. You know, it's just kind of the start of the conversation. So for me, I've always done my best work in the woods or while I'm traveling. And it was a really cool experience in writing a book about food in particular in foreign countries. I know that you've been to Thailand and a few other places. I remember that story of you accidentally getting the pedicure and then getting rid of your calluses.
That was in Vietnam when I I decided a luxury pedicure was in order and realized that all of the hard work I'd put into building up the calluses on my feet disappeared within 10 minutes of pedicurage. So,
and the same thing happens to your gut when you go to certain places, right? And you eat whatever they serve you in Thailand, whatever the heck is in that sauce or whatever in some cases. So you have to be especially conscious of how to source your food in very bizarre situations. So we've tried, you know, eating bugs when we were in Thailand, and, you know, we were just in Peru, as you said, and the way that people live in these different places, you can kind of see what it does to their culture, what it does to their physique, what it does to their energy. And I think one of the most promising things is when you go outside of America, and especially the West, into places like Bali or Indonesia, and you meet these people who eat and live in a completely different way, they kind of have a lot of things figured out that Americans don't or have forgotten for some reason. But you meet a lot of people in different countries who are just kind of naturally fit and healthy and, you know, have good color, and they live for a long time. And you're just like, oh, it can be like this. This is what we're after. So yeah, I wrote a lot of the book while we were in the East or in the Southern Hemisphere. And I tried to bring that perspective to the book, that this isn't hard. It's just, you kind of have to unlearn some of the stuff that has been indoctrinated into our own minds just as a result of growing up where we did.
Actually, related to the travel item, this is one of the questions I don't want to ask you. Maybe I'll save it for the end to keep folks on the edge of their seats. You have an adventure pack that you put together when you travel. You talk about Abel's adventure pack in the book, kind of like the way
survival gear.
You put together healthy travel. So I actually want to ask you about some of the contents of that pack, but let's push that forward for now. And I have a bunch of pages folded over in your book. And so for those of you listening in, the name of Abel's new book is The Wild Diet: Get Back to Your Roots, Burn Fat, and Drop Up to 20 Pounds in 40 Days. And Abel's actually been on this show before. I'll put a link to our previous episode. He's got his own podcast. He's known as the Fat Burning Man on iTunes. And we've talked before about some other issues related to fat burning. But in this book, Abel gets into some stuff that I haven't heard him talk about before or discuss with him. And so, Abel, I think this is the perfect opportunity for me to put you on the spot and find out more about this stuff. So what do you think? You ready to jump in?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, cool. So you talk about fat fasting in the book, this concept of fat fasting and typical foods you'd eat when you're doing something like a fat fast. Can you go into fat fasting and what that actually is?
Yeah, and some of your listeners are probably familiar with the idea, since you're, I think, one of the people who's really spearheaded the fat-based approach to athletics, which is a totally different animal, and I'll be honest, a lot more hard than doing it if you're just a normal person, you know? So for me...
because power bars are so easy to find.
Right. For me, I was fascinated by when I started tinkering around with under-eating during certain times of the day or fasting. It's kind of a generous definition of fasting. What it means is that, you know, in the mornings, I'll generally have some heavy whipping cream in my coffee or tea, which is basically pure fat without much of the lactose to worry about or the carbs that come with regular milk. And I'll also take something like fish oil or have coconut oil or coconut fat and kind of under-eat during the day, almost like raw vegan during the day, during daylight hours, while I'm doing most of my work, which might be playing music, recording, writing, doing interviews like this. And I found that I didn't get hungry until I started eating actual food. And so it got to the point where all of a sudden, you know, it's 3 o'clock, 6 p.m. And I'm like, yeah, I guess I could eat now. Mm-hmm. But if I start the morning, like I used to, with a huge breakfast, even if it is mostly fat and protein of solid food, I find that I do have the kind of like hormonal counterattack a few minutes or hours later where I'm hungry again, I'm a little bit lethargic. So I found that actually withholding solid food and maybe just sampling from a little bit of fats or raw greens gives me great energy throughout the day. And it gives your body kind of this, you know, the cyclical approach that looking at time is something that you can use to improve your own health is something that I really tried to instill into this book and into my own practices, where, you know, you have these times where you're digesting after you eat, which for me and my wife and most people who kind of do it this way, is in the evening after the sun goes down, you eat your big meal and you happily fall asleep with that that energy crash that you actually want at the end of the day to kind of optimize those hormones that help put you down. And then in the morning, you're running on that big meal that you had the day before, and you don't really need to be focusing on when you're eating, how much you're eating, or whatever. You're just kind of doing your thing and looking forward to a big hearty feast at the end of the night.
Right. So it's a cyclic ketogenic approach, but you're putting a spin on it where you're actually purposefully keeping yourself in a hypocaloric state,
right,
and simply using like doses of fat to give you just like a slow fatty acid bleed as you're in that state.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay, gotcha. That's interesting about heavy cream too. A lot of people will avoid dairy products, period, when they're doing something like ketosis or when they're trying to avoid when they're trying to avoid sugar because of that lactose content that you brought up. But when you choose something like heavy cream, you're avoiding a lot of the milk sugars that you'd get in other milk sources, like say whole milk or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. And I find that, you know, I've tried it with other things like MCTs and coconut oil. But they just don't taste as good. And I, you know, a big part of what I do is try to make it awesome and fun and taste great. So for us, we just really enjoy finding the best quality food that we can find, and occasionally kind of combining it with some scientific type things like MCTs or whatever. But mostly it's almost like a compliance move, right? You take a couple hits for things that might not be totally 100% optimal for you all the time, just because it makes living this way so much easier and more awesome.
Yeah. Now, you go back and forth between diet and fitness in the book. And so during this interview, I'm also going to go back and forth between that a little bit. But on page 86, you have what you say is one of the best pieces of fitness advice that you ever got. What is that fitness advice?
page 86. I don't have it in front of me.
I'll actually read it. I know it's, trust me, I've written books before. And like I've gotten questions like that. It's like the oh crap, what did I say on that page moment? You say, break a sweat every day doing something you love. And I think a lot of people hear the break a sweat every day part of things, but don't necessarily pay too much attention to the last part of that quote. Can you go into what you mean by that and how you've implemented it?
Yeah, well, that kind of goes along with the heavy cream thing, right? Like, I come from a family of dairy farmers, and I've always learned to love certain things. And when people, one thing that I saw when I was coming into the health field with my podcast and blog is that there was so much like misery instilled in it, you know, that you have to be torturing yourself if you want to be lean and healthy. You need to be super restrictive. You need to exercise yourself more than you've ever wanted to. And that's a drag, you know? And when I figured out that it really didn't have to be that way to an extreme, you know, we've had many conversations, Ben, back in the past, of how much I can actually get away with and how much all of us can get away with if we're doing the right things, focusing on intensity as opposed to long misery, you know, endurance type exercise. If you like endurance exercise, like, you know, I ran marathons during a period of my life. I really enjoyed it, actually. I did it in a, I come from a family where a few of us are pretty good runners. And, you know, I was never nearly as good as the best one. So I was doing it more as mental practice, as something that, you know, you can use as an excuse to go outside and meditate for a while. Because there's a big difference between running a marathon and just going outside and running for 3 hours, right? Yeah. Just going out for a nice jog in the sun on a Sunday when you have time. And so I tried with everything that I do in my own life to bring that happiness to it. You know, I don't know why, but for about 10 years, I didn't ride my mountain bike, but that was my favorite thing to do when I was a kid. I raced competitively on mountain bikes, and then for whatever reason, you know, moved to DC, then moved to Austin, and just didn't have a great bike. And then while we were off the grid, we were in Moab, Utah, one of my favorite places, and I saw this really just rad red. And it's basically like, you remember those Rambo trikes that are like all black with a red lettering?
Yep.
It's like if Batman had a mountain bike, that's what this thing is. Nice. And so I got it, and I just, you know, I've been pure bliss ever since, you know, and it just made me think, like, why do we withhold this stuff from us that makes us so happy? You know, it's easy to have a bike and go out for a bike ride. But you really need to make that extra effort to find those things that you love. Cause I don't love tennis or golf or like some of the other stuff that my friends might. But finding those things that you really love and then focusing on doing that every day is something that becomes easier and easier over time. You really thank yourself for it.
Yeah. And I think that the part of that too, for people, you know, there's two things I think about when you talk about this. Number one is sports specificity. Like, so many people exercise for the sake of exercising. But I find that when you actually have a sport on the radar, like an event that you're getting ready for, whether it be, you know, I want to get better at riding the mountain bike or backcountry skiing or bouldering or whatever, like even doing something like cranking out pull-ups, which normally would not seem like that much fun, can almost become sweating as part of something you love because you're doing it to get ready to rock climb or to boulder.
Yeah. You need that reason. Yeah. And most people don't, you know, if their reason is to get ready for swimsuit season, that's one that is pretty easy to trip over and ignore or give up on because it's not that compelling, right? But if you're getting ready to go like on a horseback riding adventure in the wilderness with your niece or something like that, that's coming up in the next month, then like you better get ready. You better get in shape. You can look forward to that thing. And I think for someone like you, Ben, with the amount of events that you participate in and rock, it's something that makes it easier for you to exercise like hours a day because like you have this compelling reason you want to, right? Yeah. And so like if you find yourself exercising for hours a day and you don't want to, that's not a good thing. It's not sustainable.
Yeah, part of it too, and I don't know what your thoughts are on this. Sometimes something I don't want to do becomes something I do want to do once I associate a pleasurable activity with it. Like for example, I love audiobooks. And I will do things like, do you know, like CrossFit Murph, for example? It's like if you run a mile and you do 100 pull-ups and 200 push-ups and 300 squats, and then you run a mile. And it's horrible, right? Like it's a torture fest. But if I have a good audiobook chapter to listen to, I know this sounds, you know, completely stupid to be doing, you know, some intense workout like Murph while listening to an audiobook. But all of a sudden, I'll like the workout because I'm listening to something and I'm being kind of productive while at the same time making my body better. So for me, the reason I love this quote, dude, is just because I think a lot of people just associate movement and exercise with the part of the day that they dread, when in fact it can and should be one of your favorite parts of the day.
Totally. Yeah. And there's another, there's an awesome book that I'm sure you've read, Ben, called Eat That Frog.
Where, no, I haven't read that.
You haven't? Oh my God. You got to check it out. Brian Tracy. It's a short little read. I encourage anyone to check it out. But basically the principle is, every day you have at least one thing that's big and kind of sucks. And, so that might be your workout. And so basically the idea behind this is you wake up in the morning and before you even have time to think about dreading it, you do that thing, you get it out of the way, and you use it getting done as momentum into the rest of the day. So I woke up this morning, you know, we got back from Peru not too long ago. I'm still kind of like a little bit jet lagged and just feeling, you know, being cramped into trains and planes and taxi cabs that are teetering off of the Andes Mountains is not usually that pleasurable and not that good for your body. So I wasn't feeling that awesome. But I knew that I wanted to do a high intensity workout. One of my favorite ones to do is like Tabatas. I call it my 7-minute workout, where basically I'm doing burpees for 20 seconds, resting for 10. And I repeat that 10 times and I have a quick little warm up and quick little cool down. Then it's done. And while you're in it, you're like, oh my God, yes. Like it hurts so good. But when you know that it's just 5 minutes, then you can totally do it. And then, you know, you feel so much better. Even if you start the day feeling crappy, one of the best things you can do is get your blood flowing. And you're like, oh, I feel awesome again. Like let's make that, let's make a point to put that in our calendar. So I make a point to put that in my calendar, that particular workout at least once a week. And, it's life changing. It's allowed me to continue to be fat burning man while not working out like fat burning man, if that makes sense.
Eat that frog. And by the way, if you're listening in, if Abel mentions stuff like this during the show, I'll write it down. I'm keeping notes and you can check them all out over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/wild diet. That's bengreenfieldfitness.com/wild diet. Okay. So another thing you've got in here is about rice. And a lot of people, you know, especially in like the paleo healthy eating ancestral community, they consider rice to be a relatively safe starch. But you have some thoughts on rice that you talk about in terms of different types of rice, the way that they're cooked, wild rice or black, forbidden rice, things like that. And you have a few opinions on rice and whether or not it's good or bad. Can you go into what you've learned about rice?
I'd say the biggest mistake that a lot of people make when they're getting into paleo or getting into even diet, generally speaking, is that something like rice is rice. And they'll ask the question, is rice good or bad? And that's like, it's a difficult question because that's like saying, are eggs good or bad? There's a huge difference. We're coming out with a big blog post right now about the difference between 99 cent a dozen eggs that you get at Walmart compared to those with the hard shells full of nutrients that you get from backyard chickens. It's a similar thing with rice. It's like the rice that we're used to eating in America kind of comes out of an ice cream scoop with your school lunch, right? But when you go to other parts of the world, or even when you go to the Southwest where you can find wild rice or forbidden rice, you find that it's a completely different food. I mean, it shouldn't even be called the same thing. So yeah, there are so many different types of rice, and a lot of them are more like a legume than a grain, or more like a bean type in texture. Almost nutty in some cases. You know, I love forbidden rice or black rice, which is kind of this long grain, nutty flavored, almost purplish grain that doesn't really feel like a grain when you eat it, and certainly doesn't taste like one. It's very substantial. And there are other things like quinoa. Actually, down in Peru, it was so cool because we got to drive through the Andes Mountains, and you could just see these vast fields of quinoa. And when you go down there and you eat it, they eat it in a completely different way. It's almost always sprouted, and it's almost always in a soup, as opposed to, you know, the exports, which people kind of like grind it up, turn it into flour. They turn it into something else that's more processed. The biggest takeaway from this is that rice isn't rice, and no food is what it says it is. You need to look at how it's made, where it comes from, how processed it is, and really explore all the different varieties that there are. Like, I never knew that I loved red rice because I'd never tried it until I went to Indonesia. But it's kind of, it reminds me of the huge fluffy oats that my grandmother used to make back in the day. And it's really a pleasure that a lot of people are missing out on.
Now that you're home, have you found a place that you can get rice like that?
The internet is amazing for a lot of weird stuff like that. But I think wherever you can go locally is generally pretty good, because people can, you know, if it's a small mom and pop health food store, they can usually order stuff pretty easily, whatever you want. And then
yeah, that's a good point.
Even Whole Foods, you go into the rice aisle, and most people don't really spend much time thinking about it. But if you look, you know, there's rice from all parts of the East and West, and different kinds. And we've gone to Native American shops. We're in Arizona right now, and found wild rice next to like the Navajo ghost medicine smoke stuff. So it's like, sometimes you have to look in weird places, but it's amazing.
Your description of rice was pretty amazing compared to like the tiny grains of white or brown rice we're so used to eating here.
So
and of course
boring.
you go into big machines and cheap oil and pesticides and things like that too. So of course there's all those considerations. Now, another thing that you talk about is Pottinger's cats. Mm-hmm. On page 109, you talk about the curious case of Pottinger's cats. I think a lot of people don't know this story. Can you explain?
Yeah. So back in the day, there was this scientist, there was this lab where they were experimenting on cats, and they would take some of the organs out of the cat, you know, one of these horrible experiments from back then. And the diet of the cats themselves was kind of an afterthought, as it is in many labs. But they found that these cats were, over the course of time, getting sicker and sicker. And when they removed one particular gland from these cats, especially, and combined it with the fact that they weren't eating their natural diet, they were eating foods that were slightly cooked or slightly processed or highly heated in some cases. When they were on this diet, those cats in the first generation were kind of okay. They had some degenerative stuff. They might have problems with carrying a little bit of extra weight or just not living as long. By the second generation, it got worse. Third generation, almost none of them could reproduce. And by fourth generation, they were basically Jabba the Hutt, just, you know, blobs of this, barely resembling a cat. And what they found, they kind of linked that back to an essential nutrient for cats called taurine, which is also great for humans. And but this is all illustrative of the fact that when you process food, there is a very distinct effect that it has on the body of the animal. And nutrient deficiency is nothing to mess around with. But I think the thing that I kind of like barely mentioned in the book is that if you look at that illustration of what happens to those cats as a direct result of food processing, and then you look at what's happened over the course of generations since the 50s or 60s, if you look at pictures, even your own family pictures back then, most people, they might carry, 20 extra pounds or something like that. But for the most part, they have clear skin. They have the bodies that they were supposed to have, it's not carrying extra weight. They're mostly fit. If you look at wartime pictures, but then over the course of time, like with each generation, we've gotten fatter and sicker, more and more blob looking, less vital. And food processing has been the thing that's really taken over. Like I was saying about the eggs and the rice, it's really taken over our entire food system. 90% plus of beef that we get in the US is from factory farms, which is straight out of a horror movie. These animals don't even get to move their legs. And so that's starting to happen to us. And so that's why I think that the stories like Pottinger's cats are so important, because, it's just happening to cats is something you might say to yourself. But when you think about it, you're like, oh, man, it happened to my whole family.
Yeah, I think the other interesting thing here is this whole concept of epigenetics. I know that Pottinger was feeding this crappy diet to generation after generation, but there's kind of this concept that if you eat crappy, even if your kids start to eat healthy, they're still going to be affected by your crappy eating.
Right. And that's the kind of terrifying piece of it.
I got this question at a conference a couple of weeks ago where I was speaking, and someone said, well, why do you do this? Like, what's your motivation? And, we talked about looking, feeling, and performing really good and being able to get the human machine to do what you want it to do whenever you want it to do that. But yeah. I mentioned a big part of it for me too is the Greenfield name, right? Like the fact mm-hmm. that I want the Greenfield generations that come after me to be symmetrical and beautiful with good skin and to have optimized height and good genetics. Mm-hmm. And a big part of that for me is knowing that when I choose, whatever the carrot versus the macaroon, that maybe I'm making a decision that'll affect future generations too. So right. I love this Pottinger's cat story. And related to that, you also talk about like diets for pets, an actual, what you call the wild diet for pets. Is this the way that your animals eat at your house?
Yeah, we have a 75-pound yellow lab who's just like pure energy. And we take her also when we're traveling around North America, not to South America, but when we're traveling around, like we've been doing for the past year, we take her too. And so we know how important eating well is, not just for ourselves, but for, our pets too. And a lot of people, it's so interesting when you meet someone and they hear, you're a health guy, you're a diet guy or whatever, they don't want to talk about diet or what they're eating because it's like way too personal. There's a lot of stuff that's caught up in it. And I totally understand that. But sometimes you can get to people by saying, well, what is your dog eat? And they, it's like, well, I give him the best food ever. And then let's look it starts with corn gluten. Mm-hmm. Interesting. And then it goes downhill from there. And so when you get them to revisit, like, what would a wild dog eat in its natural environment? And you're like, well, I guess it would eat other little rodents and animals and meats, and maybe the contents of the stomach of a kill or a rotting mm-hmm. carcass, or maybe some apples that were fermenting on the ground or something like that. And it's one of the coolest things is as we've been doing this for quite a while, we got her as a puppy a little more than 3 years ago, and we've been feeding her raw pretty much ever since, which means, you know, taking half a chicken and throwing it in the backyard and having that be her exercise, you know, getting raw meaty bones, which help clean her teeth and give her nutrients that are almost impossible to get from a can or from kibble. And, you know, we'll make some sacrifices, of course, but a lot of people have gotten this impression that you can't feed animals food scraps from like your own kitchen table because it'll make them fat. And I think if anything, that's really more commentary about what we're eating than what they can and cannot do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we've got our dog on the barf diet right now, which mm-hmm. I think is, you know, it looks like you're using things like bones with the muscle meat and raw bones, organ meats, raw eggs, vegetables, looks like fruits to a limited extent. And, you know, that's similar to what we're doing. Barf diet is bones and raw, I think it stands for bones and raw food, something like that.
Something like that.
Anyways,
yeah, I remember coming across that years ago. It's very helpful. They have a few guides that are fantastic.
Yeah. And especially when you list off the list of ingredients that are on the label of pet food and what they really mean, like you talk in here about how meat products can include slaughterhouse fecal waste, poultry feather meal, connective tissue, leather meal, and horse and cattle hair.
It's just
part of the meat in the dog food that you're buying. It's right. Crazy. So this, I love your idea of this wild diet for pets. And to me, it just makes complete sense to look at the ancestry of your pet. And, you know, I guess maybe a wolf would be a little bit different than say a Chihuahua. It's a little bit tougher to look at the ancestral diet of a Chihuahua, but I guess it's still a wolf at heart, right?
Yeah, it's not nearly as different as people make it out to be. And like, why would a Chihuahua eat out of cans, you know, any more than anything else that's living would eat highly processed food? The thing about pets is that unfortunately it's from a regulator's perspective, it's so much easier to sneak these like non-food products into the feed of animals. I mean, even when you go to an agricultural store, they sell feed for animals. They don't sell food, right? And I think there's an interesting distinction there where, you know, they might be feeding them cement kiln dust to make sure that they fatten 30% faster, which is something that was done and still is done by the cattle industry because they, you know, found out that it fattens their animals. It's not food though, and it's certainly not nutrition. And the reason that these animals are getting fat is because they're sick. So I think we need to get away from saying, "Oh, I'm going to read the marketing on the front and feel comfortable about what's in it." We need to really turn it around, look at the back, and if the first ingredient or second or third or any ingredient is something that you can't pronounce or you don't know, then maybe it's not food.
Yeah, yeah, it makes sense. Okay, so let's go into, I'm sure part of this was related to, the marketing of the book, the part on the front where you say drop up to 20 pounds in 40 days. And then you've got another story, I think it's on page 310, where you talk about dropping 25 pounds in a month. And, you know, obviously, if you look at a lot of the research out there on fat loss and weight loss, you know, that's a really large amount of weight loss in a short period of time.
Yeah.
How is it that you're able to achieve that? Or what were you able to find in researching the book that was allowing people to actually lose that much weight within 30 to 40 days?
So I spent a lot of time in a lab doing science that way. And I really much prefer guinea pigging on myself where there are no rules and just kind of seeing what I'm capable of. And what I wanted to do is demystify the experience. I'm not ever going to say that losing that amount of fat and that amount of time is healthy necessarily, but it can be in some cases. And it's certainly not impossible. I mean, if you can lose 20 pounds in a month or even in 40 days, then I assure you can do that in 6 months or a year. But mostly this is something that in specialized circles that you're aware of, I'm sure Ben and a lot of your listeners as well, losing, like for crew teams, losing 20 pounds in a month is something that's kind of normal in a lot of ways. Or like if you're a wrestler or a professional athlete,
Well, when I was bodybuilding, it was at one point 10 pounds in. It was about 3 or 4 days that I did my final 10 pounds and cut.
Right.
You know, from heavyweight down to middle heavy.
Yeah, and like one of my buddies did a bodybuilding show in Austin, and I kind of coached him through the ketogenic part of that, and he went from, I think it was 211 down to 179, maybe it was even more than that, 215 down to 179. In just a few weeks, and watching that happen was a spectacular feat, you know, to witness. He was miserable. He was absolutely miserable, and the weight came right back on. But it's possible. And so the whole point of saying all of this is not because this is something that you should aim toward necessarily, but if you think that it's not possible for you to lose weight, if you're carrying extra weight, then know that it is, you know, and, you want to do it in a healthy way, in a way that's right for you. But I think just that getting rid of the limiting beliefs that you do need to starve yourself or that you do need to do these extreme things to get those results is what I want to take away from that, because you don't need to be that as extreme as you think. Like for me, it was kind of interesting because I never really knew that I could get fat until I was in my 20s working a desk job, gigging nights and weekends, moonlighting as a computer programmer, and all of a sudden my lifestyle really caught up with me, and you know, I was working with this low-fat diet that my doctor was recommending, and all of a sudden I'm 20, 30 pounds overweight. And so I went from that to doing the complete opposite, kind of a cyclical ketogenic style diet with a high-fat focus and losing 20 pounds in 40 days. So that's where that experience comes from. I really wasn't trying hard, but I was a young buck in my early 20s, already exercising, doing a lot of things right. And that's just kind of something that happened. It took me back to normal. Mm-hmm. And that's what I want people to take away from this, is that by adopting these positive lifestyle practices and eating the right way, you can go back to your normal, which is different for Oprah than it is for, you know, a lot of other people. You know what I mean? Like you have to look body type.
Yeah. One of your tips in the book I love, and it's basically to take any beverage that you're drinking, right? Like you talk about fruit juice, soda, diet soda, coffee, beer, sports drinks, energy drinks, anything. I know this sounds boring to folks, but you do recommend you can put citrus or mint in it, and to just do water. Like pure
so
water.
Easy.
And I know a lot of people are probably thinking, oh, what about kombucha, or what about if I drink Zevia or whatever? But I think this is a good point, because number one, even when you're drinking like the stevia infused beverages that are probably safer than like acyl sulfamy potassium and sucralose mm-hmm. and stuff like that, you still do get a little bit of a release in insulin. Like you still do, if you're not careful, get that propensity or that urge to still consume calories, right? Within mm-hmm. like whatever, 30 to 60 minutes after you have that sweetened item. And then the other thing is, it's like, even if you do something as simple as give up coffee and maybe a couple of other beverages, like say tea, there are a lot of people out there putting things into their coffee and tea that add up long term, right? Like, you know, it's 100 calories there. It's a little boost in insulin here. And, you know, by the time you look at it over the course of a month, you could see how just replacing your liquids, not making any other dietary changes, and just replacing your liquids with water could actually result in some pretty profound weight loss.
And really easy. It means, like, this, I got that from actually a guy who was on the crew team in college, and he needed to drop weight fast. And all he did was give up any beverage that wasn't water. And he didn't change the way that he ate or exercised, and he dropped 25 pounds, I think, in a month. That was his example. And I was like, whoa. Well, you know, I guess if you think of giving up all of your drinks, then that's hard. But if you think of basically that's the only thing you do and you get those results, that's pretty freaking awesome. And if we want to be honest, most people are not drinking enough water. So that's such an easy win, because even if you just do that, most people will lose weight from drinking more water, because you're detoxifying, your body is getting the hydration it needs. And if you're talking about, this is probably the most boring way, aside from sleeping more, that you can get awesome energy, is just by drinking more water.
Yeah, well, nobody's going to sell many supplements either from the water diet. Although you probably could potentially have a pretty big market for making regular water taste different. And then you start to head down the same road that we were starting down in the first place, which is, I drank something that tastes sweet. My body releases all these hormones that makes it want real food. And so where's the food? Bring it on.
Yeah.
Okay, so you talk about the worst thing to do when you're sick in here. And specifically you start to get into chicken noodle soup and the beef that you have with chicken noodle soup. Can you go into that?
Oh man. It's rough when you come to this realization, right? Because it's an emotional one. When you're sick and someone makes you soup, you're like, "Thank you," you know? And then you realize that soup is poison. Same thing with rice and eggs, like I talked about before. Our chicken noodle soup didn't used to be the way that it is now. If you look, in the book itself, I go through the ingredients, and you know there are like three different types of things that may or may not be MSG, which is an excitotoxin, very bad for you. It's in so many different ways, but they actually use it to literally induce obesity in lab rats. And then, you know, super low quality chicken, industrial processed salt, all this junk in this broth that's not actually made from things that have nutrients in it, but, you know, essentially like bouillon cubes, just salt and artificial flavorings. If you contrast that to the thing that actually makes you healthy, like chicken noodle soup, you take a chicken or a poultry or bones, and you make it into a stock, and you put a little bit of an acid in there, like vinegar, to leach the minerals and you know, the magnesium, the sulfur, and all these other things that help break down the connective tissue and open up your own body to being nourished with something that's completely easy to digest, like a soup or a broth. Maybe throw some veggies in there and some fresh herbs. That is nothing like what you get in a can from the grocery store. And unfortunately, the most, you know, they're still using this marketing. It's junk food, but it's sold as health food or as food that you're supposed to have when you're sick. And that's appalling.
Yeah, that's what baffles me is when I talk about bone broth on my show and I'll recommend bone broth to my clients. Mm-hmm. I will get photos and people will be like, "What do you think about this bone broth? What do you think about that?" And it's just bone broth that they bought from the grocery store.
Right.
I mean, even if you look at some of this stuff from like Whole Foods or Nuggets or wherever, I mean, it's still got a lot of these things in it, like yeast extract and soy protein isolate and dehydrated garlic and, you know, a lot of compounds that are far different than you throwing a organic chicken carcass into a crock pot at home and making it yourself. But yeah, it's a good point. Like when you're sick, eating chicken noodle soup might not, you know, no matter what your mother used to tell you, be the best thing for you.
Eating Campbell's anyway.
Yeah, but eating Campbell's,
bone broth exactly. Is, I mean, I think I put that in the book. There's a proverb that says a good broth can raise the dead. Yeah. And I have experienced that firsthand.
Yep, exactly. Okay, cool. So the moment that people have been waiting for, Abel's Adventure Pack. I know that you've been doing a lot of traveling, so some of this stuff is likely very fresh on your mind.
Yeah.
What is Abel's Adventure Pack? Why does it exist and what's in it?
So I got this Camelback backpack years ago, and I've tried all sorts of other ones, but for whatever reason, this one is still my favorite, like the way it feels, what it's got in it, the pockets in all the right spots. I don't even use the Camelback part for that. But it carries my laptop so I can work. And more importantly, it carries all of the things that I need to basically make sure that I'm cool no matter where I am. If I have food, what food is put in front of me, I don't have to eat it necessarily, or I can make it more palatable by spicing it up with something. So I found this one thing a little more than a year ago called the Spice Missile. It was like $9 at some adventure store. And basically, super simply, all it is this little thing with three capsules that are divided in half with little shaker tops on them. And so in it, I have kind of this rotating array of spices, but sea salt with minerals in it, usually some sort of spiced pepper. I really like cayenne peppers or hot peppers or red pepper flakes. So I'll put that in there. And then also for the more like delicious things for my coffee. I'll have cinnamon, which also helps with blood sugar if you're going to eat something a little bit sweet, or I'll put it on some apple with some mineral salt if I'm out for a hike or something like that, and then some cocoa as well. And all of this fits into something that's just a little bit bigger than like a chapstick. And it's maybe three chapsticks or something like that, but that's just one of the little things. And then also I carry around, coconut manna, which I think you're a big fan of too, that the coconut cream.
It's basically coconut butter, infused with coconut flesh.
It's the best. Basically,
what it's called is, I believe coconut manna is synonymous with coconut butter.
Yeah.
But what it is the flesh mixed with the oil.
Yes.
I think is what it comes out to.
So it's got a nice sweetness without too much sugar, and it's basically pure fat, and it's the right kind of like short and medium chain fats, which give you great energy without really risking fat storage. I carry those around, and little fresh nuts if I can, or nuts that I roast myself, or little packets of nut butter. And also I carry around things like a water bottle that has a little charcoal packet in it. So even if, I don't like to waste bottled waters. I worked with energy companies for too long to realize how bad that is, just the sheer amount of waste. So a lot of times I'll use something that can filter my water to make sure that I'm always drinking plenty of it. I carry around lots of tea.
What kind of water filter do you use?
It depends. I'm like you. I like to test a bunch of different ones, but I found this really cool thing. I can't remember who makes it, but I think I put it in the book actually. It's just this, it's like a tea bag that's filled with activated charcoal that doesn't leach out. It just absorbs the impurities of whatever water you have. So if you're drinking something that's highly chlorinated, which I don't really recommend, but sometimes is necessary, that really helps a lot.
Right. Okay. So that's like got it. I've used a Life Straw before, but I haven't used this thing.
Yeah. Life Straws are cool.
Okay, cool. Anything else that are must-haves for you?
There are a bunch, and I recommend people.
I know it's like four pages long in the book.
Yeah. this is also like for me something that I've been working on for my whole life I was an outdoors guy at Dartmouth, led a bunch of trips.
Yeah.
Not just for myself, but for carrying things that will really improve the experience for a lot of other people who haven't really been in the woods that much. And also, as a touring musician, I have stuff. Usually when I travel, I make this little tonic I'm a big fan of tonic type drinks and, like wild mushrooms and things like that. Deer antler in some cases, and echinacea, and the whole herbal side of things. I'll take like the 30 things that I think I'll need for those 2 weeks in my cabinet, put them into one little bottle, and then have that every day as part of my supplement routine. So I always have supplements, tinctures, tonics, teas, water, and a lot of backup food, maybe sardines or, smoked mussels or oysters or something like that. Maybe even sneaking a little pate in there. And then also having weird foods like cucumbers, right? Which are totally awesome. As like a non-sugary apple type thing. But if you're in the desert, it's also a source of water. And so like going to these other countries has really taught us to think about food in a very different kind of like survival oriented way.
Yeah. It's interesting because a lot of people I've found are resistant to the idea of carrying all this stuff with them when they travel. But number one, you'd be surprised that, you've got 4 pages of Abel's Adventure Pack in the back of this book. You would be surprised because your pack looks somewhat similar to mine at how small. I don't check luggage when I travel. I travel with one large backpack and then a book bag.
Right.
It's got my laptop and stuff in it. Everything in my personal travel essentials kit fits in that backpack along with my clothes.
Totally.
Granted, I do often take a shower with my clothes and then stomp on them with a towel after the shower too. So I don't travel with tons of clothes, but still,
such
it all fits. But then the other thing is like, I travel a lot. And I simply have the mudroom, like a little shelf in the mudroom where most of this stuff is, where when I'm packing for the airplane, I'm not rushing around the house trying to find all these items, right? Like, right. like my water filter or like, you know, the little sleep hacking stuff or the specific supplements I only take when I travel. Like it's all there in one place. So I just grab it and go. And it's not as hard. And I mean, a lot of people, you know, they don't step back and look at how much of a dent travel makes in their nutrition and right. their fitness progress. And these business people who are traveling like 10 days out of the month, you know, they're like, sure, you're working out and eating healthy for 20 days. And then your life goes to crap for 10 days because you're not planning.
Yeah.
I love this pack that you put together.
Thanks, man. Yeah. I was a consultant for years and kind of lived that lifestyle. And you realize at some point that it's not good for you. And so you need to kind of fight fire with fire sometimes and just be prepared, you know, like have sardines so that you don't have to eat some greasy sub that they try to make you eat at this conference or whatever, you know, like get ready for being disappointed with the food that shows up or doesn't show up in your life when you're traveling.
Yeah, exactly. Sardines and some good breath freshener, right?
Oh, absolutely. Especially when you have it with coffee.
That's right. Cool. Okay. So this book, if you guys are listening, you want to get it. I've got our Amazon link to the book. If you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/wilddiet, along with some of the other resources that Abel and I talked about on this episode, it's an easy read, but it's got a lot of gems in it, as you probably have guessed by listening to Abel and I talk. So definitely one to check out and add to your library. So again, you can go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/wilddiet and check that out. Abel, thanks for coming on the show today, man.
Thanks, man. This is fun.
All right, folks. Well, this is Ben Greenfield and Abel James signing out from bengreenfieldfitness.com. Have a healthy week.
Visit bengreenfieldfitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness, nutrition, and performance advice.